We're using four points, putting gentle justice in the middle of a circle, and saying that our spirituality that we're talking about has a center, and that center is active, reconciling nonviolence, or gentle justice. But in order for spirituality to be more full-blown, it needs more than a center. And we're working with word, solitude, community, and world. Yesterday, we primarily spent time with Jesus as the norm. That's the word by which we live. The world is our reality, and that is a world of violence. And the community in which we live as our turf, the first place where we live out the spirituality. If we are unable to live out gentle justice in our own faith community, we probably don't have anything to offer to the world. In other words, we spent some time in the first session on three of those four points where we sit down. Tonight, we're spending time going across that circle. We're trying to link that time of solitude, contemplation, prayer, vision, meditation, and global justice. And we're going right through the middle of gentle justice. What would it mean that our spirituality, are we okay? Farther away from the mic, sure. Can you still hear me if I'm out here and the tape, is it picking up all right on the static? All right. Tape ministry, we are now going to officially begin. My name is John Schramm. This is the second in a series on gentle justice toward a healthy spirituality, and tonight's topic is contemplation and global justice. This is not a sermon. Even though we're in this building instead of the other, I do not preach a sermon. Vespers comes at 8 o'clock, but I do have a text. It's from the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, 22. The eye is the lamp of the body, so if your eye is sound, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is not sound, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? I chose that text because you probably have some understanding, we would have a mixed understanding perhaps, but some understanding of the phrase global justice. To do justice is to set things right. Global justice means our whole world, and you've had some indication within the last 2 or 3 years, more than probably in the rest of your life, of the fact that we live in a global village. And that there is a division between North and South, or the developed nations and the underdeveloped, or the most seriously affected, the MSAs. We no longer can even speak about third world. We now have a fourth world and a fifth world. We're going to try to connect contemplation and global justice. I don't think perhaps we would have had as much immediate connection with the word contemplation. Probably you feel that's fairly far from your ordinary life. Contemplatives don't sound like someone that you live next door to or work with, or are part of your family. Maybe those at Holden Village think that they've chosen a brief respite from the active world and that they are now contemplatives, but I think most of us have trouble connecting with the word. I chose this particular text because of the different words we use to describe that part of our spirituality called our prayer life or our solitude life. Contemplation is the word among all of them that has the most to do with seeing. The technical definition is to gaze intently. It's a visual image, contemplation is. So if the eye is sound, the whole body is full of light. I guess there could be a very simple connection. In order to set things right, first you have to see clearly. So we could say, lecture's over. The connection between contemplation and global justice is, unless you see it, you can't do anything about it. And unless you see it clearly, you'll probably mess it up when you try to set things right. Maybe some of you would be happy if that's where it ended. Rather than just make a simple connection like that, I'd like to open up some aspects of the connection between contemplation and global justice. I will admit, in the connections I make, I have some mentors. I started with Benedict of Nursia. And since that's the way he is described, I tried to do the same thing with some of the other mentors, Thomas of Kentucky, or Dorothy of New York. Are you still with me? Or Teresa of Avila, or Henry of who knows this year where he is. Do you know who that is? That's Henry Nouwen, if you didn't know that he moves every 6 months. If you know those people, you will know something about my mentors. They are all Christian. That doesn't mean that contemplation is not very much part of Eastern religions and other world religions. In fact, some world religions are probably far ahead of our Western Christian tradition. I know that. And yet my mentors, I think the ones I related to more easily, come from my own faith community. So they have shaped me more than some of the others, even though I've tried to read some about contemplation in other religions. If you knew the people that I listed, there could be others, but if you knew the ones I listed, they were all Roman Catholic. I think it's interesting this afternoon that Rosemary Ruther answered the Roman Catholic Church is a good place to get disillusioned and angry, or whatever she said when someone asked her a question about Mary Daly having left the Roman Catholic Church. Maybe it'll be us Lutherans who find the good points in the Roman Catholic tradition this week, because we have a good, healthy mix on the teaching staff. Very frankly, I find a richer tradition of contemplation in the Roman Catholic tradition and the Eastern Orthodox tradition than in the Protestant and the Lutheran tradition, especially in the religious orders. I think the Roman Catholic tradition has placed a higher regard on the life of contemplatives and on contemplation as an important ingredient in the Christian life and faith than Protestantism has. I mentioned yesterday that there is a book, Luther and the Mystics, by Bengt Hoffmann, and there is more research about Luther being influenced by Tauler and some other mystics, but by and large, I think my mentors come from a tradition other than my own. I said yesterday that my premise this week is going to be that of the points of that circle, you probably major in one or two of them. You may major in living word and the words of Jesus and biblical consciousness, or you may major in activism, bread for the world and peace in Nicaragua. And that may be, if we ask members of your parish, what do you think of when you think of that person? It might be social activism. Or you may major in community building and really work hard at making whatever your faith community is a real family of faith. Or you may major in solitude and prayer and contemplation. But my emphasis and my premise this week is growth for you will probably be to move to one or two of the ones that are not part of the central aspect of your faith now. And so for me to move into the richness of another tradition, I think has been growth. And I encourage you to do that also. You may also know, if you know the list of my mentors, that they all make a connection between contemplation and global justice. In other words, I went to mentors who shared my hunch. Don't you? Don't we choose a counselor because of what we think we're going to hear from that counselor and not another one? Sure, I went with what I felt instinctively was right. That doesn't mean that in the history of contemplation and solitude and global justice, that everyone makes those connections. In fact, I may be presenting a minority view tonight, and you ought to know that. Of the mentors I named, probably Thomas Merton will influence tonight's presentation more than any other one. Next week, I'm going to do a whole hour on Merton and his life and his writings. But not only do I steal from Thomas Merton tonight, I even get the idea for the parts of tonight's presentation from him. When he writes New Seeds of Contemplation, he has several chapters on what contemplation is not before he gets into any description of what it is. And what he's saying is we probably have to unlearn some things before we can move into it. And I'm going to have the same premise tonight, and all of my statements are negatives. First one is this. Contemplation is not seeing some different world. It is seeing this world differently. That's going to be key to the spirituality that I'm presenting and key to an understanding of contemplation, and that may shock you. I said that probably most of you thought you were far from contemplative living. I may be exaggerating as I describe your preconceived ideas. My preconceived ideas before I studied contemplation, especially in people like Merton, was that a contemplative was someone who sat with eyeballs rolled up in constant religious ecstasy. Kind of living in a never-never land. And if you passed one on the sidewalk, you would give him or her at least 10 feet distance. A kind of strange, out-of-it person. When I thought of mystic, I did not think of Thomas Merton's first response to what a contemplative is. When someone says, what is contemplation, or who is a contemplative, Merton answered, someone who knows what the scoop is. That's very much what we're trying to say in this first part. It's not to see some different world, third level of nirvana, seventh heaven, some kind of rose-colored glasses that keep you away from reality. It's precisely the opposite. It's to see this world differently, and it's to see this world disillusioned. To see this world with the eyes of fire. That the gospel, rather than being a giant bear aspirin that numbs us, is the most disillusioning experience that anybody can ever have. That's the premise. And the connection between contemplation and global justice, then, is to see clearly, to see with eyes of fire. Jim Carroll, a mentor that I did not name, in a little book on contemplation said, contemplation is to know that Eastern Airlines lies. I don't know why he picked that airline. He could have picked another airline if someone here works for Eastern. You always get in trouble when you say Eastern Airlines lies. The point is this. The monk, I read contemplative monk, and monk, by the way, in its earliest use, referred to male and female. I'll refer to monk in the oldest sense tonight because it included everybody. The monk is essentially someone who takes up a critical attitude toward the world and its structures and stands in contradiction to the prevailing values of the world around. And the reason is the monk, the contemplative monk, is disillusioned. It means to get away from the propaganda. The rediscovery by the church of its fundamental identity as a contemplative people is not a flight from social political responsibility. On the contrary, once we begin praying again, and once we take seriously the contemplative vision that we are heirs to, we become more socially and politically restless than ever. The American denial of its own best dream is built on the premise that no one sees beneath the surface of things, but contemplation sees with eyes of fire. Everything social and everything political is called into question. Far from amounting to a surrender of involvement in social change, the commitment to a contemplative way of life is a profoundly political act with specific implications for everything from prison reform to exploitative trade practices. Anyone who tries to do an act of religion that is not political understands neither religion nor politics. I think you'll make some connections with Rosemary Ruther's God language this afternoon when she said that. And if that's a kind of shock to you to use the word political, that's not partisan politics. A contemplative is not clearly a Republican or a Democrat. What political is the polos, the socialness of our humanity together. Contemplation brings you very much into that polos, or our common life together. A contemplative is one who thinks that the Sermon on the Mount makes sense, that the Christian gospel and the values of this culture may be on a collision course. But that the question is not, does Christianity make sense in a sophisticated world like ours, but does a sophisticated world like ours make sense if you have a Christian perspective on things? Which one is the touchstone? For the contemplative, the touchstone is the faith and the eyes of fire. In fact, it's the very opposite of numbness. Matthew Fox says, all meditation is about waking up. Or again, that which distinguishes the contemplative is not eccentricity, but sanity. Not perfection, but conscience. Henry Nouwen, the mystical life is the life by which I grow toward what is real and away from illusion. I think our culture thinks in terms of the contemplative, sitting, looking at the sunset, as some kind of religious nut, and the family glued to the TV as living in the real world. I can remember, Elmer, you probably still get it, I was here 6 years, I can remember week after week someone saying to me, you've been up here quite a while. How do you function when you go out into the real world? I knew what they meant by that, and I didn't want to give a facetious answer, but if we really had time, I kind of pressed on what was real. I would point to mountains or listen to the stream, point to the problems of living in community, and then say, is real the Wenatchee Mall and Muzak and plastic? And sometimes we really did have a good conversation. I knew what they had meant, but it is interesting that somehow this is not the real world. I think a contemplative has moved away from a world in which manufactured needs are met by manufactured goods, and has said that's not the only way someone can live, and has become disillusioned. We have to recognize that when our self, our wholeness, our person, is defined by others, then we're living in illusion. We can see that in other parts of the world. Talk to a Namibian who needs a passbook, who needs permission from an oppressive government to do anything, to say anything, to go anywhere, and we will know that that person's self is defined by someone else. We saw someone's self defined by others in the midst of the racial ferment in the United States. Mary and I lived in a section of Washington, D.C., almost entirely black, and the young women of that neighborhood spent most of the money, it seemed to me, on hair straighteners, because someone else had defined what it meant to have a particular look, and so their self was defined by a majority white culture. But it is harder for us in this culture. If you take the world divided between North and South, if you're given only two choices, you know there are two kinds of people in the world, those who will divide the world into two kinds of people and those who refuse to ever do that. You're coming, it's there. If you do that, knowing that it's dangerous, if you divide the world into oppressors and oppressed, we, the oppressor nations, the wealthy nations, the big nations of the world, have a much harder time realizing that our person is defined by someone else. And we need a contemplative vision to see that. It's very hard to break out of an illusion because the illusion is culturally bought by all of the other people that we live with. So what is there to break us out of an illusion? It's like, when was the last time you had a temptation that was not attractive? You'd have never bought it if it wasn't attractive. It would have flopped as a temptation. The same way with an illusion. You would not have bought it if it didn't seem absolutely true and if everyone else had not bought it with you. So it takes, I think this is the reason I think this is the reason that contemplatives have been ascribed the idea of seeing some different world. What they do is have a viewpoint that is outside of this common culture, and therefore it seems as though they live in a different world. They don't. They see this world differently because of a particular point of view. Pascal has a beautiful quote on that. When we are seated in a moving vessel and our eyes are fixed upon an object on the same vessel, we do not notice that we're moving. But if we look further upon something that is not moving along with us, for instance, upon the coast, we notice immediately that we're moving. And it's the same with life. When the whole world lives wrongly, we fail to notice it. But should only one person awake spiritually, the life of all the others becomes immediately apparent, and the others always persecute those who do not live like them. It's the one little boy who said the emperor has no clothes. Remember, it was that one voice of innocence that broke through. Or Merton says it this way: this is precisely the monk's chief service to the world. This silence, this listening, this questioning, this humble and courageous exposure to what the world ignores about itself, both good and evil. That's the role of contemplation. Not to see some different world, but to see this world differently, because the disillusioning process, that time away, that time alone. And part of that is precisely the solitude. Merton used to say, did you know that the monastery was set up consciously and deliberately to be boring? I used to worry about people coming in, getting off of the bus, and looking at a whole week on the bulletin board. There is not any possibility that if you choose, you cannot be entertained 7 days. You could come to this place and not ever be alone. Wouldn't that be a tragedy? To come to this place out of all places, to spend all the time to get to a place apart, and then not have the possibility. The reason that the monastery is boring is that you might face the desert within, and that you might be cut off from all of those influences that keep you from being a real person and that give you your identity, instead of letting that identity come from the work of the Spirit that is always disillusioning. Moving on. Contemplation is not seeing some different world, it's seeing this world differently. And secondly, contemplation is not taking ourselves too seriously. This is a little presumptuous for someone from North America to say in the global justice arena, let's not take ourselves too seriously. It's like North Americans telling people in Central America that they ought to be nonviolent. Let's all be nonviolent. I still think, even though it's easier for us to say, I still think it has a very valid place, and I hope that comes out in the few remarks that I have. If contemplation is to see clearly, then when we see global injustice, it's possible that we take ourselves so seriously that we feel we must make history come out right. And I think that is a temptation for those of us who feel we are the ones who have the power to do that, that we must make history come out right. A contemplative vision never leads to this. No, in fact, a contemplative can best be described as the one who has been enough in the silence to be aware of one's own poverty and one's own lack of answers. In fact, I think in the struggle for global justice, it's this not taking ourselves too seriously and being able to step back, even have a sense of humor about it, which is probably the redemption, that contemplation gives the gift of that to those who are most intimately involved in global justice. And I'm not speaking theoretically about that. I think one of the great things that I experienced in Nicaragua was the sense of long-term commitment to a global justice struggle, but also this dimension of not taking themselves too seriously. One day they had a fiesta. And somebody from our group from North America said, with all that you have to do working for the revolution, how can you take a fiesta? And they said, you obviously are not in it for the long haul. If you're in it for the long haul, you know you need fiestas. That's what I'm talking about on a contemplative vision. I paraphrased E.B. White yesterday morning. It's a crummy, crummy, crummy world out there. And it is a beautiful, beautiful world. And when I wake up in the morning, I don't know whether to fight injustice or to smell the flowers, and it makes it very hard to plan my day. Keep that tension. That's part of the contemplative vision. It's possible. It's possible in fighting injustice with all of its viciousness, and it is vicious. There are people here who can tell you about it from experiences in the last couple months. It's possible that the fighting of that injustice can turn you into a beast. And sometimes the most grim people are those who are working for peace in the world. That's possible. That a strong commitment somehow takes away the joy of life. And that's a dimension of contemplation that I do not say facetiously as the second point. Maybe the most important thing we're talking about. I had an illustration of that in the Community of Christ. Mary and I lived in Washington, D.C. for 7 years. And our community was primarily a white community in the midst of a primarily black, it was a racially mixed neighborhood, but we didn't have too many blacks. One of the reasons was we had a basement congregation. We did not want a church building. And we realized that was a middle class luxury for us to think that was kind of groovy to be a church without a church building. And for the blacks in our neighborhood, they had already been in storefronts. They didn't have the luxury of saying, well, we don't want that. We want to meet in the basement somewhere. It would take another few decades till they could say, we don't need a church. That's how dumb we were about what would appeal and what wouldn't appeal. But we had one young black law student at Howard University, a fine, fine young person. He could kid about it by the time we met him. It wasn't funny when he first came up. He came up from North Carolina and wanted to start law school and didn't know you needed 4 years of college in between. He said, that's how much of a hick I was when I hit the nation's capital. One day, he shared what it was like for him to grow up in Carolinas as a young black boy. He said, fun for older white boys was to drag us face down through dust and sawdust until we almost choked to death. He said, there wasn't anything in my growing up that didn't say, hate whitey. And he said, the only thing that saved me was the woman who raised me. He wasn't raised by his own mother. This woman he called Muddy, I think, because he couldn't say mother or mommy when he was little. She came up to D.C. and we got to meet her. She would say over and over again, Alex, don't ever get anybody to get you to the point of hating them because it'll destroy you. She just told him that over and over again. And when he gave a shared word at the Community of Christ, he said, that's probably the best thing she ever taught me. Muddy doesn't ever has never heard the word contemplation. I'm just saying that she had an awareness of truth that she could share with that young boy that probably did keep hate from destroying him. That's what we're talking about. Let me say that I think it's even okay to tell a story that doesn't sound very profound as far as contemplative vision, but maybe says it in a way that gets at the truth. Mary and I, during the years in Washington, D.C., we were in an area called DuPont Circle. And when Lutheran churches are started, there is a comity committee. It's often facetiously referred to as the comity committee, but it's C-O-M-I-T-Y. That meant in those days that the Missouri Synod, the LCA, and the ALC all had to say yes before any one of them could go into a neighborhood. Well, the American Lutheran Church wanted to start new work in Washington, D.C., and the other two synods kind of had their objections to all of the neighborhoods we had suggested. And we finally got way down on the list to DuPont Circle. And I can still remember both of the other synods say, we wouldn't touch it in 50 years. It's go ahead, good luck. That's where we went. Well, why? It was the hippie neighborhood. It was rooming house neighborhood. It was mostly businesses. It was kind of empty at night. It was kind of a funny neighborhood. And it was also where all the runaways came. And the Presbyterians decided that it was time to have a ministry to the runaways. The church always gets together and says, let's have a ministry too. Well, they brought in a young Presbyterian pastor named Tom Murphy. And he decided the best way to minister to the hippies and the runaways was to go where they went every Saturday, to the P Street Beach. What this was a little bit of grass next to a very smelly little stream that flowed somewhere into the Potomac River. It did not qualify to be called the P Street Beach, but that's what it was called. And every Saturday there was a bee inn. Anybody remember the bee inns? Everybody came and you just were. Those were great days, weren't you? Just were, all day. Well, Tom Murphy put on a clerical collar and had a stack of mimeograph pages and sheets, and he went around handing them out to all the hippies. And he got to this one tall, likable young hippie, and the hippie said, look, Reverend, if it's not immoral or illegal, I won't do it. And Tom grinned, looked him right in the eye, and said, this is not immoral, and this is not illegal, but you do it. And he handed it to him. All it said was, if you want to take a leak, come over to the Church of the Pilgrims and use our bathrooms. Perfect start for a ministry. The word spread. Hey, the guy's all right. The guy's all right. It was that kind of age in which one night, four or five of those young people had a delight on their hands. They had myself and a Benedictine monk to pin to the wall with, it was far beyond any forum at Holden, on its animosity toward white male representatives, professional representatives of two major churches. And they were proposing, ultimately, there is no difference between a mature secular humanist and a mature Christian. And all of the easy arguments were already far batted down. You couldn't say one was moral and immoral. They had posited a mature secular humanist whose morality would go beyond any Christian I have ever met. And you couldn't say selfish and unselfish. They had posited an altruistic, mature secular humanist whose unselfishness went beyond any saint in your church or mine. Well, whether it was the hour, a couple beers, or the Holy Spirit, your theology and piety will choose one of those three. Anyway, for some reason, about 11:30 at night, I said, yes, ultimately there is a difference. And they perked up. We hadn't been doing well, this monk and I. I said, the mature Christian will always have a better sense of humor. And they got interested, some of them for the first time in a decade, in talking about the Christian faith. I think now, 20, 30 years later, I don't think I would say anything different. I think that's what Luther wrote about in the hymn, take they then my life, goods, fame, spouse, life, children, what, when they their worst have done, they yet have nothing won, the kingdom ours remaineth. That we are not so caught up in a particular venture that our worth is dependent upon the outcome of that. The gospel gives us a certain nonchalance, a God-given nonchalance, that I think you can say, sense of humor, if you have a little time and you're not talking about a good joke teller or a stand-up comedian or that every preacher is some kind of a spiritual cheerleader, ah ha ha, with a plastic Christian smile all the time, but really a better sense of humor is one of the gifts of a contemplative vision. And the last part. The connection between contemplation and global justice comes not at a new technique. I think some people think that contemplation must be such a highly developed technique reserved for a few saints that it's so far from most of us that whether it connects with global justice or not is academic, because we could never be that. Rather than being a technique, it's stopping all of those ways that we've been hiding from God. In the simplest language, to be a contemplative is to know God by heart. And very frankly, this is the place where I think my own church and my own seminary and my own tradition has nurtured me the least. No one yet ever got drunk on the word wine. And we think you can get intoxicated with God's Spirit if you have the right words about God and the Spirit and a Spirit-filled life. It is not true. A contemplative is someone who knows God by heart. I remember telling the story at a retreat once. Henry Nouwen is a delightful person. By the way, Elmer, he is humble, unassuming, and the one time I had a chance to visit with him, he said, I would love to come to Holden Village someday. And I said, I bet you you could get in if I put in. So if you accept him, say, John Schramm said you're all right. And then I... And he said he had a student for a while at school that was just always on his case. He always had a question. There wasn't a class where he didn't have a question. Henry was relieved when he graduated. And he went to an Episcopal church somewhere, and he came back a year later, and he knocked on Henry's door, and he said, Henry, I'd like to visit. No questions. I won't. I just want to visit. So they came in. And after 3 or 4 minutes, when Henry had said, how are things going, and he described his parish, there really wasn't much else to say. Henry didn't know enough about the parish to be interested. I mean, it just kind of... And so he said, and how are things going at school? And after 2 or 3 minutes, their worlds were not really connected anymore. They didn't have anything to say, and they just sat. And it was quite a while with nothing being said. And then the young student said, oh, it's so good just to be here. And Henry said, you're right. It's good just to be here. And the student said, it's like being in the presence with Christ. And Henry said, wait a minute, no. And then he said, well, maybe it's the Christ in you sees the Christ in me. And the student said, but do you see what that means? That means wherever you go or wherever I go, the ground between us will be holy ground. I told that story, and a young woman, lay worker in the Lutheran church, said, you know, I told that story once, and a Lutheran theologian who is a heavy, when I finished, said, that is not Lutheran. And she said, I was just absolutely wiped out. I was embarrassed. I was crushed. I wasn't there. I want to answer for her to that heavy. Now you know one of our problems. That has not been our nurture, to talk about the Christ in me sees the Christ in you. That has not been much of our upbringing, to know God by heart. But a contemplative vision somehow has that experience. This serene hunger of the Spirit penetrates the surface of words, goes beyond the human formulation of mystery, and seeks in the humiliation of silence, intellectual solitude, and interior poverty the gift of an apprehension which words cannot truly signify. I don't know all that that quote means by Merton, but I know it invites me into an experience of contemplation that's going to be extremely important if I'm going to be committed to global justice. I have to have some kind of vision in the messiness and the sheer routine and the day after day of struggle Let me tell you one more Henry Nouwen story, because he really does have the stories that bring alive contemplation. He talks about a little boy who walked down a street in Rome, and he was by a huge warehouse, and he heard noises in the warehouse. He looked in. Where he was at a sculptor's studio. The sculptor worked in marble statuary, and the boy was just fascinated. And the sculptor was very kind, took time, explained what he was doing and what have you. But the boy was fascinated the most by, in the middle of this warehouse, there were railroad ties with a huge block of marble. Boy, it took him a long time to walk around it. And he looked at this block of marble. And he left. Months later, he came back, realized he was on the same street, that the artist had been kind to him. He went back in, and immediately, he knew there was a change. The block of marble was not there anymore. The railroad ties were there, but standing on the railroad ties was a huge marble lion. And the boy went over to the artist, and he said, "How did you know? How did you know there was a lion in there?" And the answer that the artist gave the boy is an answer that most of the world has never understood or accepted, but always known by a few. Before I saw the lion in the marble, I had seen the lion in my own heart. We need that contemplative vision in the struggle for global justice. Mother Teresa refers to those who work with her as contemplatives, not social workers. I was the head of Lutheran Social Services for 7 years, and I can tell you, social work would have given up years ago on the problem of the dying on the streets of Calcutta. Use any form of triage, and you'd put your resources somewhere else. Only a contemplative with some kind of vision that went beyond the capabilities of human services would continue to do that. Contemplation is an important ingredient for global justice. Irving Kristol was head of the Urban Studies at New York University, and he resigned not long ago. He gave a resignation speech. It has three sentences. One, I don't have anything to say anymore. Two, I don't think anybody does. Three, when problems get this complicated, you just lose interest. I go with him on the first two. Even while I'm giving a talk and it's being taped, I don't have as much to say anymore as I used to. And I go with the second one. I'm not sure other people have as much to say as they're saying. But I don't go with him on the third one. I don't think that's a time to lose interest. I think it is a time to have a new interest in the transforming power of God in a contemplative vision, to know God by heart. Why does it surprise us that we're not attracted and other people are not attracted to global justice? Why does that surprise you? It's messy. You might get killed. Why would your dream not be a hot tub and a cabin somewhere where you could sit in a rocking chair and write strong sermons on commitment? Doesn't that sound a lot better? It's only when there is some kind of global justice and compassion and connection, where those who are being oppressed, that we're connected and we say, us. To pray without ceasing is to bear in one's heart the pain of the world's injustice all the time. That's what it means to pray without ceasing. And to not go under is the gift of contemplation, of not taking ourselves too seriously, of seeing this world with the eyes of fire, and of being empowered because we know God by heart. I want to announce ahead of time that I changed the style a little bit because we're over here and discussion is not quite so easy. I also want to announce ahead of time that the one tomorrow on Is Meditation Too Complicated is not a lecture. If you come, you will share about your own prayer life, as embarrassing as that is for most of us, and we will do some praying together. But tonight again, I talked. So, but we do have five. I do want to end by five of so that we can get ready for Vespers. But there's time for some comments and feedback. No? Okay. We don't have to have any. Let's assume that the connections of today with the present teaching staff at Holden, it's a good week, the connections between what Rosemary did this afternoon and Karen and Mary are doing and Spence, that the time for you to really let that come out is a forum, and that tonight's forum, I think, will get at least at one of the issues that came out yesterday in the session about the relationship of church and world, church and state, or what is the role of the church, or what could the church do? And I think that does connect with both contemplation and global justice. So let's assume that you'll have your chance tonight. And you, yes, June? Yeah. Do I know why?
No.
Do I know? Why is it? First of all, it could be challenged, but let's assume that we're talking about my premise, that the idea of contemplation and the mystical has not been a heavy part of the Lutheran tradition, and that I had to look to other mentors for this dimension. It probably includes the fact that Lutherans have a lot of Swedes, Norwegians, and Germans. It probably includes the fact that that our theology was very heady and male. It probably includes the fact that it was a reformation from some abuses, including abuses of the lack of clarity of doctrine. Sometimes I'm extremely glad for Lutheranism that makes sure things are right, orthodox, doctrinally right, and done decently and in order, because I think there's some awful things done in the name of the Holy Spirit. But I don't know that I can answer, but I think our roots, where they were, and the reason that we started means that we have something very clearly to contribute to the Church Catholic, and we have some limitations where we can gain from the Church Catholic. I don't know that that's a very complete answer, but I think in a Lutheran church, if you get a shiver up and down your back, you'll look to see who opened the window, not assume it might be the Holy Spirit in our midst. Elmer. Jungian?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense to what you're saying, or a connection with the experience
that? That people, instead of choosing between, like Roman Catholic, Orthodox, or Lutheran, choose between a basically Christian or Jungian, Carl Jung, or Jungian tradition. I'm not sure that is where I know something about Jung. I'm impressed with much of what I read about Jung, but I guess I haven't seen people choosing that instead of some classic or particular Christian religion. You certainly mean far beyond knowing what Myers-Briggs type you are. It's very popular. Jungian psychology or psychiatry or the school is very popular. Let's take a break. Thanks very much.
Testing, testing. For our worship tonight, you need an Ever-Flowing Streams book and one of these white sheets. Please share on both of them, the Ever-Flowing Streams and the white sheet. Testing, testing. 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 Testing? Testing. Testing? Testing. 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 Welcome to Tuesday Evening Vespers. This is the time of day when we welcome those who have newly arrived in the village, and the registrar catches up with the people she overlooked last night. I didn't get all of our staff introduced last night, of those who arrived yesterday, so I'll try to make amends tonight. If you are one of those who newly arrived in the village today, would you please stand as I read your name and remain standing until the whole group is introduced, and then we'd like to greet you with our applause. We welcome from Park Forest, Illinois, Barry and Rebecca Bruckner with Randy, Chris, Becky, and Greg. From Yamhill, Oregon, Lee and Linda Schreppel with April, Matthew, and Becky. From Boulder, Colorado.